Let me tell you about the plan to retire the U.S. dollar. In my research, this is my belief of how things are going to work out in the next couple of years. I passed this by several people, and they believe it's solid, but I want you to know up front, this is what I believe is going to happen, and it is all tied to things that I know are already being put into place. Right now, there is a race going on for digital currency. It's a three-horse race, and Bitcoin is not in it. It's the U.S., China, or the IMF, the World Bank. We are looking for what is going to be the world reserve currency. What is going to replace the U.S. dollar? Russia and others are pushing out digital currency, et cetera, but they're a tiny portion of the global currency power, and they're really not relevant, in my opinion. The U.S. Federal Reserve is behind China on the actual digital currency implementation. China already has the digital renminbi, which I just love. How many renminbis do you have?
Nobody remember.
I have 11 trillion.
You have 11 trillion. That is good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they do all of the intergovernmental transactions via the Bank of China. So in other words, the Communist Party passing money to the Communist Party posing as the bank, and then the Communist Party getting that money back. It is renminbi is the people's money in Mandarin. However, even though they've already pushed this out and they're already using it, the U.S. is way ahead when it comes to potential adoption. 70% of international financial transactions right now are settled in U.S. dollars. This is what gives our dollar any kind of value now, whereas only 1.5% of the global transactions are settled in Chinese money. Several analysts believe that the U.S. will have a digital U.S. dollar issued by the Federal Reserve by 2022. Now, I want you to listen because this is really important to your future. They want to get it out. This is according to several analysts. They want to get it out before the midterm election because the Republicans may retake the House or the Senate or both. The Fed doesn't require technically any kind of congressional approval to issue any new digital currency, but that doesn't mean that Congress wouldn't move to block or slow it just to limit the Fed's authority here. Lately, Yellen and Powell and the head of the FBI have all started warning Congress and the public about the dangers of Bitcoin and other decentralized cryptocurrencies because they can be used by sex traffickers. And they can be used by terrorists. And so the plan is to issue a digital U.S. dollar and then automatically convert U.S. dollars from the old U.S. dollars to digital U.S. dollars, DUSDs. Okay. The banks would issue the DUSD at some ratio that the Fed would set. Now, here's why this is so important for you to be ahead of the curve on. The money in your bank account will suddenly become U.S. or DUSDs overnight. But that doesn't mean that it's going to be dollar for dollar. In fact, the Fed is going to be deciding how much loss everybody takes. The Fed will also offer U.S. dollar cash holders, physical cash, but not in the banks, to cash in old USDs for new DUSDs for some time period, 6 months or a year. And the way they'll do this is require cash holders to deposit the money into U.S. banks so they can control the conversion to DUSD and track all transactions. After the cutout date, the old U.S. dollar will be retired either overnight or via an overtime graduated retirement schedule. The conversion rate is just going to get worse and worse. So they're going to say, hey, you'll get 80% of your dollar if you turn them in now. And then, you know, the next month you'll get 70 cents on the dollar. And so it will push people into pushing their money. The convertibility rate, analysts are now speculating that it won't necessarily be equal. So in other words, not everyone will get 80% or 70%, Part of the plan here is to do social engineering and wealth distribution. They're going to have a progressive, like we have a progressive income tax, this will be a progressive conversion rate. It'll be the same way we do progressive tax structure. Poor people are going to get a one-to-one ratio. You might even, if you're one of the afflicted groups, get a 1 to 1.5 ratio, meaning you get 50 cents more for every dollar. And wealthy people could get a 0.5 to 1 conversion rate. So the more you have in U.S. dollars, it may be the less U.S., the digital U.S. dollar you'll receive in return. Now, the reason why they're retiring the dollar is because we are spending into oblivion, and they don't have an exit plan other than the death of the dollar. In the near future, they don't need to care about the debt or inflation because they can effectively buy unlimited amounts of old currency with new currency and force the cash holders to take the loss because they can make all other currencies, including cryptocurrencies, illegal whenever they see fit. So by controlling the currency and having the power to declare what currencies are legal and what are not and how much those cash currencies are worth, all cash holders will accept whatever terms they want. This is the end game, I believe, for the U.S. dollar. And I don't think they're going to get, you're not going to. It'll be interesting to hear if anybody in the press picks this up and makes fun of me on it, because won't they be shocked? Oh, there is a caliphate. Oh, 2008 did happen. Yeah, I'm telling you, it is coming. The question is, how much can we get other countries to take a loss on U.S. dollars that they currently hold? The sovereign U.S. dollar holder is probably going to take a 50% haircut, but private party dollar holders will accept maybe a 90% loss on their U.S. dollars, and it will create a race to dump dollars and to put them into other currencies. The way we're going to get global support on this is we will offer foreign debtors, countries that owe the U.S. government money, we'll say, look, I know you bought those tanks and those planes. We'll give you a 50% cut on your debt. You just turn everything into U.S. Digital dollars, and we'll call it a day. That's what's coming. So when you see all of this spending, know that if you aren't aware of what is right around the corner, you are going to lose. It is why I urge you to watch tonight's TV show. Tonight's TV show is so important because we show you the mechanisms in the financial industry that are being laid right now to make things like this happen. I mean, how do you give a 10% haircut, a 50% haircut to all Americans? How do you do that? Well, timing. Timing is important. Stu, did you notice, what were we talking about where he said timing? It was on the
guns.
On the gun bill last week, right? He was saying the timing just isn't right. There was something else that he was talking about yesterday where he was talking about the timing just isn't right. They either have fortune tellers to see what's coming next, but I don't know if they can foresee trouble coming, but yesterday the World Health Organization got a whole buttload of countries, like 40 some countries, to sign on to a global treaty where they'll all act the same. The Biden administration didn't say that they wouldn't sign that treaty. They said the timing isn't right just yet. Wait, what does that mean exactly? That you will sign a global treaty where the WHO tells us to shut our businesses and we do? What does that mean? Find out more tonight at 9 o'clock on blazetv.com. We're living in a country now that I don't recognize. I've never seen in my lifetime where you have to wait. I'm an American. What? Wait. What do you mean it'll be 6 months before it's here? And that's happening all the time. And people say there's no inflation. Well, as somebody who has had to buy a lot of plywood lately, really? Because that piece of plywood used to cost about $12, $15. In some places in the country, it's now $56. What's up with that? We are hitting inflation. And $1,400 in Biden bucks is not really going to hold us over. This is more important than the other headline news. We have a real crisis at our border that we need to pay attention to. But there is a, you know, there is an article run in the Scientific American about how climate anxiety is an overwhelmingly white phenomenon. So it's not enough to be concerned about the climate. If you're white and you're doing it, you must be part of the problem. We need to reevaluate our priorities and be less concerned about whiteness and climate anxiety and more about the technology that fuels human civilization and the country that has pioneered most of it. There was another story that I read yesterday, and I don't even know where this was from. Let me see. It was on... Okay, it doesn't say. But this was an article that came out, and it was talking about how collecting has become a very big deal since COVID. And it talks about, you know, retailers are reticent to speak about the trend, stating that they don't wish to be on the record talking about nearly sold out of $90,000 earrings during a time of growing wealth inequality. People are buying watches because they're on the home at computers all the time. And so these people who are really rich are just going through the online catalogs and looking what's up for auction, et cetera, et cetera. Rolex day dates that sold on the secondary market in 2020 for $30,000 are now going upward of $50,000. Patek Philippe watches are now, you could buy them for $85,000. Now they're going for $200,000. And the reason is, they say, because Switzerland, they're not making any watches right now. So there's the demand. This article was written to make you hate rich people and how they're just buying a Mickey Mantle, you know, baseball card and how much that's worth now, or how they're buying these old classic cars because they're how much they're worth. My grandfather told me that during the Depression, you watch what the rich people did before things got bad. Because it was as if the rich people knew something that we didn't know. And that's true. And there weren't a lot of rich people. There were people like Rockefeller back then. Now there's people with real wealth all around the country. And so some of them might be spending this money because they're bored. Or usually we go onto the yacht, but we can't get out onto the water now, so I might as well buy a $250,000 coffee table. What this article does not tell you is that some rich people are now buying things of value because they know things of intrinsic... The Germans did this. In hyperinflation and before the war, they were buying things of real value because the dollar, or in their case, the mark, was not worth what it was just the year before. And as you start to devalue, some people say now that your dollar is going to lose about 48 cents in the next 4 years, about 15%. Each year will be lost on the value of your dollar. So if you have $100 in the bank, in 4 years, you'll still have $100, but it will only have the purchase power of $51 or $52. Okay? That's cutting your wealth in half. And it's only because of what they have done at the central bank, the Fed, and in Washington to that dollar. You've played by the rules. This kind of situation hurts people who have played by the rules. Don't be surprised when you see things that auctions of art and everything else going for huge amounts of money, and cars all of a sudden are going for huge amounts of money. And that was a 1968 Mustang. Why is it going for so much? Because people who know, people who see over the horizon, are buying things of intrinsic value. They know that if they put in, I don't even know what an old Mustang cost. $100,000, $200,000, whatever. I mean,
a very nice Mustang.
Yeah, I have no idea. Sure. But like a showroom quality, yeah. You know what
old
I mean?
Old school.
Mm-hmm. You know that $200,000 in that car is not going to lose 50% of its value in 4 years. It's not going to. Somebody will buy that for the equivalent of $200,000 or maybe even $150,000 four years down the road, but not in American money. You know, it will be more expensive in American money.
People are using these items as a store of value.
They're using them as a savings account. That's why Bitcoin is going and doing what it's doing, because Bitcoin has gone up 200%. Okay, you could go down 175%. Okay, still I'm gaining 25% where I'm going to have it in a bank account and I'm going to lose 15-20%. Yeah, you might want to think about that. The reason why I'm telling you this is not that, you know, we have an audience that's going to go out and buy really expensive, you know, Mustangs. Jay Leno, I'm not sure if he listens to this program. You need to start thinking about those things. You know, I said to somebody the other day, I don't smoke and I don't drink, but I think it's probably a pretty good idea to buy cigarettes and vacuum seal them, to buy alcohol and just keep it. Because if you don't have any money, people are going to look to trade things. And I don't know, cigarettes. I don't think I know anybody that really smokes. But
I've been trying to start, but I haven't. I haven't got it going yet.
Yeah, I know. It's tough. That was my New Year's resolution. But, you know, alcohol, things that people use. You don't have to go out and buy a Mustang. You just have to think, what could I have of value that people are going to need or want? Need is where most of us can get into and protect ourselves. What is it that people are going to need that they may not be able to afford to buy, but they might have something else that I can trade for that I might need? You have to start thinking about protecting your wealth differently. I think really for the first time, since the Great Depression, and maybe the first time ever, because if this continues and we continue to spend like this, there will be no dollar left. So every dollar that you're holding on to will become worth less and less and less until it's worthless. Everything that they have ever said about, oh, it's a conspiracy theory on the Great Reset, you can throw that in the garbage now, because by their own fruits, by their own actions, you will know them. Something happened this weekend that is absolutely unprecedented. I have done this job for 40, I don't even know how many years, almost 50 years. And I've never seen anything like this. Leaders of over 100 major corporations got together and spoke via Zoom on Saturday about how they could combat election integrity laws similar to the one that was proposed in Georgia. Multiple reports, Wall Street Journal and others, directly quote people that were on the phone call. They talked about potential ways to show how they opposed the legislation, including by halting donations to politicians, fine, who support the bills, and even delaying investments in states, that's blackmail, that pass restrictive measures. Now, this is according to people who were on the call. Now, I want you to understand, what they are calling restrictive measures are actually just going back to the way it was before COVID-19. Remember, we had this unprecedented election, and we had to change these laws. In fact, they couldn't even go through the legislative branch. They just had to be done many times by executive order. And the states changed their laws to make it easier for people to vote because of COVID. Everything that they had done was unprecedented, one time only. So now these laws that are saying, okay, we're not doing that anymore, now it's being called restrictive. All the states are doing is bringing it back to where it was pre-COVID. They are just protecting what George Soros's cronies made vulnerable. That's it. Now, who was there? Delta Airlines. We don't have a full list. Delta Airlines. Citigroup. Viacom, CBS, UPS. The owner, by the way, UPS is deep in this. If you're using UPS, use the federal government's postal service over UPS, and for God's sakes, Federal Express. They may be involved as well, but I know UPS is actually deeply involved in the Great Reset. The owner of the Atlanta Falcons was there. He also co-founded Home Depot, the chairwoman of Starbucks, LinkedIn, Levi Strauss, a Boston consulting group, the CEO of AMC Entertainment, Jeffrey Sonnenfeld. He is a Yale School of Management professor who helped organize the meeting. He said to the Washington Post that corporate leaders on the call felt very strongly that these voting restrictions are based on a flawed premise and are dangerous. What is the flawed premise? That this was a new way to vote in America for COVID? The discussion, scheduled to last an hour, went 10 minutes longer. It was led at times by Kenneth Chenault, the former chief executive of American Express. Notice we have financial industry well represented here. Also, Kenneth Frazier, the chief executive of Merck. Stu, did Merck make a... Are they out vaccine? Does Merck have one?
Not that's approved here in the United States. I don't know if they've... Okay. I don't know. I'm not sure.
They told the executives on the call that it was important to keep fighting what they viewed as discriminatory laws on voting. Chenault and Frazier coordinated a letter signed last month by 72 black business executives that made the same point. The letter that first drew attention to the voting bills in executive suites all across the country. The call's goal, listen to this, was to unify companies that had been issuing their own statements and signing on to drafted statements from different organizations after the action in Georgia. This according to Sonnenfeld. Can I ask, is anyone on the right meeting with corporations? Is anybody on the right actually holding Zoom call meetings and saying, hey, look, we've got to start working together? They have infiltrated our boardroom, which was a goal of the Tides Foundation back in the 1980s. They have infiltrated our boardrooms, and now these corporations think they rule over us. They think it's their responsibility, not the elected officials, but their responsibility. By the way, some of them, because they're so with the people, some of them made the phone call from Augusta, Georgia, where they were attending the Masters Golf Tournament, which was so woke of them, I think, to be able to go to Georgia where they are protesting, but they wanted to see the Masters. Right. Okay. One Georgia-based executive talked about how the final version of Georgia's legislation, which Brian Kemp has said, actually expands voting access, a claim that the left challenges, they say was much worse than expected. And it should serve as a warning to other chief executives as more states consider adopting their own voting bills. Now, why is this? Should this be a warning to other chief executive officers? Why is that a warning to CEOs? Wouldn't it be a warning to the American people? Are we just too dumb? And so we aren't going to support some of these things. And so the corporations, they're going to act as a secondary government? One that I don't know. I didn't elect the CEO of Merck. Did you, Stu? I don't remember the ballot where I voted for the CEO of American Express.
Yeah, no, I'm not a shareholder, so I do
no.
not. No, I do not get to vote.
I'm not a shareholder, and they have one voice. Isn't this amazing that the people that are organizing this and are fine with it are the ones that say that corporations have no voice? It's the Republicans, it's the libertarians that say corporations can do what they want to do. But the ones that are saying corporations are evil, they keep people in poverty, they're the ones that are stepping to the plate and backing all of this. Why? Two reasons. One, the Great Reset. Two, they know they'll be eaten by those people. If the Great Reset doesn't work, if the Great Reset isn't the answer, then maybe Marxism is, they would think. And if that happens, they're done. Corporations, Citibank, Coca-Cola, Delta, Microsoft all have criticized Georgia's new election integrity bill. Major League Baseball, good, moved its All-Star game from Atlanta to Denver. Like Denver's any better. And this all came from the pressure from the White House. Remember, the White House is saying corporations should do this, not the people. We've gone from BLM, which is another story I can't wait to talk to you about. We've gone from BLM, a supposed grassroots organization. We've gone from the left saying that the Tea Party wasn't legitimate because it was AstroTurf. It was funded by big money. We've gone from that to now corporations openly meeting and coordinating efforts to change laws. This is fascism, guys. Fascism is when government and corporations work hand in hand. That is fascism. While no final steps were agreed on, the meeting represented an aggressive dialing up of corporate America's stand against controversial voting measures nationwide. I have to tell you, they're not controversial. It's just going to the way they were before COVID. It's a sign that their opposition to the laws didn't end with the fight against the Georgia legislation. Many of the corporate leaders who joined the call seem to view the voting restrictions as attacks on democracy. Saturday's call between company executives, this is a quote, shows they are not intimidated by the flack. And they're not going to kowtow. That's according to Jeffrey Sonnenfeld. He's the Yale management professor, one of the call's organizers. They are not afraid of the flack. So in other words, They don't care what the people who buy their products do or say. Mike Ward, co-founder of Civics Alliance, a nonpartisan group of businesses focused on voter engagement, said he felt there was a broad consensus at the end of the call that company leaders plan to continue working against any voting bills they think are restrictive, to lean into this, not lean away from this. It's going to get worse, and this is the official start, the public outing of what you're going to live under with the Great Reset. It's corporations that are going to make the rules. And it their lie about stakeholder capitalism is this. The capitalists, the ones that are going to be running the companies, the CEOs of these giant companies, not the capitalists like me or you, the small business person, but the people at Merck, the people at Citigroup, the people at Coca-Cola, they'll set the rules and they'll crush anybody underneath them. And they'll work with the government, or I should say with the left and those in power from the left, they will work with them. And your voice, well, you have a share in this too. You're a stakeholder. So your voice is at the table as well. Not on this private phone call. No, no, no. Not in any of these groups that are planning all of this stuff. No, 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 no. You voted for somebody in Washington. Well, I don't know the last time I felt comfortable with my representation in Washington. It's been a long time. This law, by the way, in Georgia, expands early voting opportunities for most counties and expands voter ID requirements to absentee ballots. And that's what they're saying they can't have, because apparently minorities are just too poor. They're just, it's too tough for them to get any kind of ID. It's so horrible. Uh-huh. Can we talk about vaccine passports for a second? Isn't that discriminatory? How is it that somehow or another minorities can not only get the passport, but will be able to get the vaccine and then the passport? Because they'll need to have that before they go anywhere, right? Why is it voting is the only thing that you don't need a license or identification to do? Why? I rent a car. I need identification. I open up a checking account at Citigroup. They require identification. They're now pushing for vaccine identification and vaccine passports. The lie does not hold up if anyone has critical thinking whatsoever.
In a recent case, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has articulated not only his concerns about the enormous, virtually monopoly power enjoyed by digital media platforms, but also shown a legal pathway to how those platforms can be restricted or regulated. Regulated in this case not to limit the access to free speech, but in fact to promote it. Now, the case that Thomas is commenting on was actually a case that is sort of moot. It's a case which was brought by people who had been blocked by President Trump on Twitter. And these people go, the president is a public figure. He doesn't have the right to block me. So this case wound itself up to the Supreme Court and ironically reaches the Supreme Court when Trump is no longer the president. So the Supreme Court in its decision goes, well, this is kind of a moot point. But Thomas, in considering the issue and in considering the underlying issues, realizes that there are issues raised by all this that are very pertinent today, even though Trump is no longer in the White House. The first thing he says is, look, it's kind of funny that the plaintiffs in this case are saying that public figures should not have the right to block them, when Trump himself has been blocked on Twitter. Trump is off Twitter. And so what kind of a public forum is it for Trump when Twitter itself, a private company, gets to decide if the public figure can even be on Twitter in the first place? And then Thomas takes the discussion to a much more general level than the specifics of the Trump case. He goes, today's digital platforms, he talks about the fact that they have unprecedented concentrated power. Also unprecedented is the concentrated control of so much speech in the hands of a few private parties. We will soon have no choice but to address how our legal doctrines apply to highly concentrated, privately owned information infrastructure, such as digital platforms. Now, of course, it's been a libertarian argument for some time that these are private platforms and they have every right to do what they do. But, as Thomas points out, wait a minute, all kinds of private platforms are in fact regulated. Radio stations are regulated, television stations are regulated, and the reason that they're regulated is that they involve the public airwaves. They involve, if you will, the public space. Now, some of those who claim that these are private platforms that don't have monopoly power make the argument that, well, you know, even though Facebook may be so dominant in this particular space, or Google or Twitter, there are some alternatives. People do have other options. But Thomas goes, that argument doesn't really fly. He goes, it changes nothing that these platforms are not the sole means for distributing speech or information. And then he gives this example. A person always could choose to avoid the toll bridge or train and instead swim the Charles River or hike the Oregon Trail, but in assessing whether the company exercises substantial market power, what matters is whether the alternatives are comparable. For many of today's digital platforms, nothing is. So the point being, if you're trying to decide if a toll booth is controlling the traffic across a river, you can't say, well, gee, you know, yeah, we are, but the guy can always swim. No, that's not a practical or practicable alternative. Thomas goes on to make the point that he's talking about Google here. And he says that when a user doesn't know where to find something on the internet, and users rarely do, Google is the gatekeeper between that user and the speech of others 90% of the time. Similarly, Facebook and Twitter can greatly narrow a person's information flow through similar means. And then he talks about Amazon and says that a clear majority of ebooks and about half of all physical books are controlled through a single distributor, Amazon. Now let's remember that Amazon is precisely the company that removed the Clarence Thomas documentary during Black History Month. They also censored a book by Ryan Anderson. His book is called When Harry Became Sally. It's kind of a critique of the transgender movement. Very interestingly, if you go on Amazon now and you search for that book, you get a book with the opposite point of view. In fact, you search that book and what comes up is Let Harry Become Sally, responding to the anti-transgender movement. So this is a clear case where Amazon is rigging the search. So you're finding not the book you're looking for, but a book conveying the exact opposite message of what you're looking for. And Thomas's point here is that these are, in his word, quote, common carriers, and they are also, quote, places of public accommodation. And what Thomas is getting at here is that when you're dealing with common carriers, the phone company, places of public accommodation, let's say a hotel, they don't have a right to exclude people. So you can't go to a hotel and they say, hey, listen, you know what? We don't like the way you look. You can't get a room here, even though you're following all our other rules and you're willing to pay. Or someone goes to a restaurant, you know, we don't really like Latinos. You can't really eat here. Sorry. No, yes, you can. So what Thomas is getting at is when you're dealing with common carriers, just as the phone company can't refuse service arbitrarily, just as a hotel or restaurant can't just turn people away, they can establish certain types of rules, but the rules have to be uniformly enforced. The bottom line of it is, what Thomas is laying out here is a legal rationale for the government, either at the state level or at the federal level, coming in and saying to these carriers, if you want to operate in our state, you're going to have to respect the free speech of all our citizens.
I just want to point out that Jim Crow laws were like, they were all things that whites could do that blacks couldn't do. Okay, that was the big thing. Like, a white could just go in, show his license or proof of identification, and vote. And blacks had to take a little test. How many windows are in the White House? Those things. That's a Jim Crow law. You know, it is obscene that everyone is talking about this as a Jim Crow law. It is not a Jim Crow law. By the way,
it's not. It's a Jim Crow law on steroids.
You know what?
If it was just Jim Crow, I don't even think it would be notable in today's Republican Party.
I have some thinking on this. For instance, the voter ID. It's racist to get voter ID. You have to have ID to vote, but it's not racist for corporations to say, if you don't have a vaccine passport, you can't come in.
Or like a bank to say you need an actual ID to open an account.
By the way, in Georgia, there are 8,000 people in the whole country, in the whole state of Georgia. There are about 8,000 people that don't have an ID. You know how you can vote? Bring in something like a utility bill. Oh, yeah. Your cable bill.
There's 13
that shows
different steps. And even if you have none of them, you can still cast a provisional ballot.
It's unbelievable.
But I mean, we're talking about utility bills and you know, work IDs and, by the way, a free identification from the state. I mean, they make it incredibly easy, and anyone could get it if they actually put any effort into it. Anyway,
it's really truly
assuming you're actually a citizen.
The drop boxes that were put in by Facebook,
yeah,
those are suddenly now permanent. I guess that's what everybody is saying. Jim Crow law is one that says, oh no, the things we did because of the emergency COVID now always have to be in there.
And of course, they are, like, for the emergency vote box thing. They had a bunch of them. They now have them still. They're just putting them inside instead of unguarded outside for 24 hours a day. Right? Like, so, I mean, is that a Jim Crow law on steroids? Like,
because I have an idea of steroids. I have an idea. Yesterday, I mean, when you think of steroids, you think, bruh, right?
Right. It's like, Hulk. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, no. I yesterday went in to get another back injection of steroids into my spine. What do steroids do? They shrink the inflammation. So if this is Jim Crow laws on steroids, it's shrinking the problem. Maybe that's what they're thinking.
I'm sure. You know what? Right. That is, you found it. I think what they're saying.
I mean,
they're not
even
just lying.
The New York Times said, this is not, and any of these changes are not going to, let me see if I can find the exact, permanent features. Hang on just a second. Oh, crap. Where was it? Here it is. Georgia new voting law suggests that laws may make in-person voting easier, especially in the general election. And that voting provisions are unlikely to significant affect turnout or Democratic chances. That's the New York Times analysis. And I'm hearing people like, what's his face? Well, I've always really liked Will Smith. It's Jim Crow law. That is offensive. Every African-American should be offended by that. That's like the Tea Party. Oh, you know what? I can understand what Martin Luther King was going through. No, you can't.
Right.
No, you can't.
Yeah, it's totally different. And it's like, you know, the ADL does this all the time. They come out and, like, if someone compares something to the Holocaust,
right,
they make it their business to come in and say, you're not allowed to do that. We need to remember the Holocaust for what it was, and you shouldn't be comparing today's things to that. Okay, well, that's okay. I mean, I understand that. It makes some sense in some circumstances, but, like, that's what they're trying to do here. You know, yeah. I mean, and it's really a bizarre thing. I mean, it does minimize what Jim Crow actually was.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Oh, yeah. If this is Jim Crow, then what were people yelling about?
The 2022 will be the most easily accessible for voting in the history of Georgia, with the exception
potentially, and this is arguable, but the potential exception of the pandemic year when everyone was at home and they had a bunch of new emergency rules that were put in. You could argue it's slightly tighter than that. Although I think you could argue the opposite too. But you could argue it's slightly tighter than that. It's definitely more easily accessible than 2018.